Station number 14981, Phil Cornell, Reel 9.
Mr. Cornell, Reel 9. How were you fed whilst you were in the trench?
Well, up to now we'd been in 2 days, that's all. Now, farther up on the hill, more into the centre of the box, was the cooking facilities. Now, we were brought food down by the cooks periodically during that time. In other words, they maintained, as far as they could, the one hot meal per day situation. But, as you say, this all happened up to now within 2 days, really.
This would be dark movement.
Oh, yes, at night time, yes. Oh, yes, aye. At dusk, after stand down, that was when you were fed.
Were you allowed to light fires, or...?
Oh, no, not in this situation. You had no need for a fire. You had nothing whatsoever to have a fire for. The battalion had their cooking arrangements, as say, farther on the hill, and it was carried down to you in tins, best tins and whatnot, big tins, dixies.
So the rations came down as a hot meal at night,
mm-hmm.
and included would be the rations for the day.
That's right. Uh-huh. All I had in my pack as regards eating, you had, I think it was one tin of bully beef, and a few packets of biscuits. The biscuits were hardtack, as you probably know all about, which is no more like biscuits than rocks were, but never mind, you've bled of them sometimes. I used to chew them for hours in the marching situations. But as I say, we were there 2 days, and I think food was the last thing you thought about that particular time.
Anything else you remember of those 2 days?
That just about covers them 2 days, to where we come to the next part of the stage, which is where we moved out of these trenches, and we were obviously going to get a bit nearer still to the Japanese. That was the intention. And we were told this on the morning by, in our case, by our own Office Connolly, that we were going in to the attack. We were going to make an attack on the Japanese. And there was quite a bit of thought going into this one. But at the time, I don't think fear is the word. But apprehensive, yes. Now, you thought to yourself, so well up to now, so well, so good. But am I going to last this next one? Because it's obviously by the sound of things and what Connolly's told is going to be a tough one. It's going to be a nasty one. And so, sure enough, he says, anyway, at 5 o'clock, we're going to move off out of here. And he drew a little sketch out. And he says, we're going up this track here. And we says, we expect to meet the Japanese somewhere in this area. And he says, they're in position, they're in a defensive position. He says, we are going to clean them out. And I think it was Cookery Pickett, the name of the place where we were supposed to be going to. However, it was 5 o'clock in the morning, I remember right. We scrambled out and we formed into lines the best we could in our sections.
Was that still dark then?
It was getting light, actually. It was becoming light. And we started to move off up this hill. Now, it was a little narrow track on the side of a hill, as far as I can remember. And I know I difficultly walked along it for the long way, because left foot kept slipping down on the side. I thought, I'm going to fall right down in the jungle down there if I'm not careful. However, we hadn't gone very far, actually in this section I was in, we had Corporal Breeden, was the corporal, was leading the section, as I said already before, he was a gentleman in every respect. And behind him, we had a Lance Corporal, and I can't remember his name. He was a Liverpool lad. However, and I would be the number one rifleman. He made the after these two, so spaced out about 5 yards apart, just to keep in contact with each other. And we started to go up this track, and Connolly was further ahead to the left of us, I think it was. However, we hadn't gone far, and this tremendous crack and a machine gun opened up, just from this slight bend in the path. And the next thing I knew was Breeden, Corporal Breeden, screaming like mad. And I knew them, we were in trouble then, all right. And sure enough, the Japanese had a fixed line on this particular point in the path, and it unfortunately cut Corporal Braden right in half with a machine gun. And whereas we couldn't get down to reach him, we did manage to drag him back round to what was left of him. He was in terrible state, and he was dead, so there was nothing we could do at all. And that was our first really bloody taste of the battle.
What effect, if any, did it have on you?
Well, I thought this is rotten. I can't say I can possibly get out of this situation now. I couldn't imagine at that stage ever getting out of this battle. I couldn't imagine ever seeing England again. I could none of that. That was all gone. I thought it's just a matter of time you finished. It's as simple as that.
Did that in any way make you feel that you couldn't go on?
No, it didn't actually. At that stage, again, difficult to describe, but a feeling set in, because it had been tough, and it had been rough even up till now. It had been rough and tough, and you'd lived in awful conditions. You'd had a lot of hard work, physically hard as well as mentally hard. It was dangerous, and this was starting to take us all a little bit. But the attitude that came over me, I don't know about other people, was I couldn't care less whether I get shot or not. And it was as simple as that. In other words, the discomfort, the horror of it all, you couldn't care less if you got killed, the sooner the better. And it was as simple as that. It's a funny feeling, but that's the only possible way I can describe it.
So really, your decision was to accept it.
Mm, that's right. Exactly, that's right. It wasn't fair because you were more or less, well, it's difficult to say, but you were looking forward to it. It was relief. The only thought that kept going in your head, will I get wounded or will I get killed? Which it'll be, but you couldn't care less. Come what may, that's it.
Was there any great fear of particular wounds? You know, you felt that, well, if I get it out, I would hate to have this registered with you.
Well, obviously, it must have entered your mind that if you were going to get shot, you wanted to be quick, didn't you? It was as simple as that. You didn't want to be suffering very long. And
you're on the track then, and mm-hmm. your corporal's being hit around mm-hmm. this bend. What were you supposed to do then?
Well, now, you've got to imagine, this was only our little particular part of the battle that I was involved with, but right round me, it was complete chaos. That's the only way to describe it. There was every description of noise imaginable, from bombs going off, shells going off, rifle fire, machine gun fire, everything you think of. A little bit further towards the right, to where we were going, was more or less in the centre of the box, was our own ammunition dump, where the arrow, and it had been hit, and it was going up indiscriminately. There were shells and bombs of our own going off on top of everything else that was coming in, because obviously the Japanese had found the dump all right and hit it. And so you can imagine chaos. There was stretcher bearers running about all over. There was calls going out, I've been hit, I've been hit, I've been hit. This was going right away around you. You never forget these things. And there was this pall of smoke and all this exploding ammunition. In little areas, there was groups of men laid out, were being wounded. Some of them dead, some of them alive. Some of them legs blown off, all sorts of things like that. And they were laid out. Actually, they had stretchers laid out on the ground and where an arm was near, and all these stretchers, they all had a wounded person just laid on them. They were getting no attention because nothing could happen at that time. They'd just been got there by the stretcher bearers, dumped on there, and then they'd gone out looking for more wounded. And as I say, it was absolute horror, but that was right away around you. And, you know, there was noises, there was mortars landing near you, next door to you, all directions. There was rifle fire, machine gun fire. But you know, the Japanese mortar, for all I have no likeness of Japanese, but there was one weapon he could use, and he used it effectively, and that was the mortar. We had our own mortars in the sections I fired one for a long time, was the 2-inch mortar, and I used to consider myself quite accurate and quite good with it, but I'm afraid we weren't a pattern on the Japanese for mortar. They had some mortars and they could certainly use them, which was a good weapon in the jungle, as you imagine, because they could fire through a gap in the trees, over the top of the trees and back into where you were, and you still didn't know where they were. And however, that was going on. It was, if you can imagine the sound and the fury of it all, and the noise, the smell, and the world, the apprehension, where you're going to get shot, that was all there. And that was at that particular stage. So however, the word was passed down man to man that we were going to carry on to our task, which was this Japanese group which were out destroy. And so we got our, I would think, not many miles, because the jungle it thinned out in places. And actually, the next thing I could see in front of me was these flashes going off in front of me. And actually, it was the Japanese were firing at us at this stage. And I thought, well, it's now or never. And of course, the pace quickened, and we started going right. The town says, it's now or never. In we go. And we started to run forward, not backwards, forward. And at this particular stage, I says, yeah, I was all keyed up, and the rifle was ready, the grenades were ready, and it's either them or me. That was as simple as that. But at that particular instant, the next thing I recollect, and I'll never forget it, was this tremendous bang, and it seemed right underneath me. Well, I was blown into the air, and I was blown up this bank side, and I remember going somersaulting in the air, and I thought, good God, I've been hit with a shell or something. Anyway, I landed on the ground, and I thought, well, I'm still intact, I'm all right. And well, it must have been, and was it happened? It was a motor bomb, Japanese motor bomb, and it lifted me. It must have been really rough. Oh, it didn't kill me. I don't. I'll never know. That would blow me in the air. That's all I know. And I thought, right, get your bands back. What do you do now? What do you do now? They had left me by these stairs. I was left on my own, he said. What do I do? And anyway, I crawled into a little bit of cover. And I had no pain, no suspect of anything else. And then the next thing I'd known was I felt some kind of a liquid pouring down my leg, with my left leg. I thought, good God, is my leg off? I moved my toes, no, the toes would work all right. And I started investigating, and funny enough, the liquid running down my leg was my water out of my water bottle. It was a piece of the shrapnel for the motor bomb. The water bottle had gone straight through the water bottle and into my left buttock. And the liquid which I thought was blood was filled in simply water. However, it had took the brunt of, probably if it hadn't been for the water bottle, with the cushion of the water inside it, it would have gone right through me. However, it was just this great big gash in my buttock. So at that stage, I thought, right, you're still alive, you're in one piece. They might be dead in front of you, they might not, I don't know, but you're all right, you're just up where you are. And, well, I couldn't walk with it, because by this stage, there was still no pain whatsoever. There was a nasty wound, but I took out my first field dressing, and opened that, and I just laid there holding this bandage on to stop the blood. And must have been the first half hour. I thought I've been over half an hour. The battle was still going on, but no idea what was happening whatsoever. No idea at all. But I thought, now what's going to happen? Are the Japanese going to come here and get you? Or are your own troops going to come back? Or will the phones behind you move them up further? Will they pick you up? So the thing is, I said to myself, was right, keep yourself under cover and make sure before you move or do anything that it's your own people that's coming. Because it could have been just as easy as the Japanese as anybody else at that stage, they were right round us. However, I sat there and I remember I had in what you call Indian woodbines, and I smoked them 10 cigarettes one after another. And eventually there was no cigarettes left even, so that was that. My water had gone. I had no water. That was all leaked out through the hole in the water bottle. And this was for 2 hours. I lay there. And I did different periods, poke my head out and have a look round. On one of the occasions, I poked my head out. Still had the hat on, of course. It's not. Poked my head out and ping, somebody shot at me. So I thought, who is he? One of ours or one of theirs? Get back down again. Take no chance. And so this I did. And I laid there. I never attempted to look out at him off, but I thought this could be a Japanese sniper. He knows where I'm at and he's waiting for me to go. However, after about 2 hours on one, which was a nasty period in time, 2 hours, and I said, hey, no idea what was going on around you, if we'd won the battle, if we'd lost the battle, no idea whatsoever. I heard a faint voice shouting, Corny, 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 where are you? And I reckon I thought, is it the Japs? No, he wouldn't know my nickname, so obviously I knew it wasn't. And so I looked, I said, I'm over here. And next thing, scrambled into this little hole where I was, this little bit of cover, was a lad, believe it or not, was from my own hometown. He lived about a mile and a half from me, my hometown in Curry Hill Station, a lad called Hunter. He said, I'm glad I found you, Corny. So am I. And he said, let's have a look. And anyway, he had a look. I said, I took your bigger dressing on. He said, you're all right, though. He says, he'll be stiff. I says, ah, my leg's stiff, I can hardly move it. And there was still no pain, believe it. I can't understand if there was no pain whatsoever. But it's a nasty sight. I kept looking at him, you know, I turned my head away shaking my head. But I knew it wasn't serious. I knew it wasn't going to kill me. And then the next feeling, of course, was immense relief. Right, you're alive. You've been wounded, but it's not serious. It's going to get you out of this nasty battle for a little bit. And that feeling was tremendous. Can't describe it really, but it was just, it could have still been nasty after that, but at that stage you thought, right, well, you can't have much more of this to take, because you'll be obviously took away and have something done about it. You'll be put in hospital somewhere, whether it's a mile behind the lines or 10 miles back. You'll be out of this affair for a little bit. And he said, right, we'll go back up into the head of the top of the hill, in the middle of the box, like. He helped me. I crawled and stumbled and walked and managed to laid me on the trash among all the other wounded people. He says, well, I've got to leave you, Connie. He said, you're all right now. He says, I said, what will happen? Oh, he says, don't worry. He says, it's all organised. It doesn't look organised. But he says, the medical, all the wounded will be took away. They won't be left here on their own. So I thought it was charming. So he wished me luck. I wished him luck. And that was the last I saw Tommy Hunter. He did survive, actually, the lad. So anyway, that was that. So again, we're on this hill now. It was still chaos, and even in the middle of the box, the disarmy nation dump was still blowing up. There was all sorts going on. We were still getting mortared and shelled, and every now and then somebody would get hit and hurt, but we were laid on a stretcher, and that's all we were, on a canvas stretcher, each wounded man. Anyway, then an officer came, one of the medicals, and he came and he checked up what you wound. And he stuck a label on you as to the extent of the wound. And I remember him asking me, he says, how far can you walk, Cornell? I says, I can walk with difficulty, but as far as necessary. I was determined I was going to stop there. And he says, you can manage. I says, I'm stiff, and it's numb and it's stiff, and no doubt the pain will follow on, but at this stage I can manage. Rest myself and pacing myself, yes. He says, right, he says, we're going to try and get the walking wounded out. I'll class you as walking wounded. He says, we'll try and get you out of it. And so we formed in the group. That was the ones that some had leg wounds, head wounds, arm wounds, but could still manage to walk in a fashion.
And what was the atmosphere of the whole of the group? You got wounded men in various seriousness of wounds. Were people panicking? Was there a lot of noise?
No, there wasn't. Never saw a sign of panic whatsoever. I can honestly say that. No panic, no fear. I could say relief and anxiety maybe, but certainly no panic of any description. Never dreamt of. Wouldn't enter my head in any form to say any panic.
The other pillar, when a man is wounded, is he crying out? Is he quiet?
Oh, some of them were in pain, and they were letting the pain show, obviously. But people were helping each other as far as they could, and by at this stage, every man had his wounds dressed, you say, which was the important part. That was the first stage of your recovery, was the first aid you received at that stage. And so he'd had your field dressing took off and thrown away, and a proper dressing put on, which was more secure and everything else. So he said, anyway, this officer said, we're going to try and get you down to the bottom of the hill. This was the bottom of Garrison Hill, of course. And I think it was the same way as we went up. We went down. I've missed the part out, and I can't remember which part it was. I remember what it was, but I can't remember what stage it happened.
Well, just give us a...
I can't remember. It was the stage where I went back, and I think I must have missed a little part out in them 2 days, where we'd moved from one trench to another, and I'd went back to get my pack, which I'd lost that particular time, I'd left behind. And however, I'd gone back to this trench, and I wasn't supposed to go there, and I was on my own, and I went down this little track back to our old trench, and as I approached it, the head poked up out of the trench, and it was a Japanese soldier pointing his rifle at me, and he fired at me, but missed me. It hit the earth at the side of me, and by the time he reloaded, I had my rifle at the trail at that particular time. I lifted up, and I even didn't take him. I just shot him point blank and shot him. and that was right in the middle of the head. And so I got into the trench, and he'd rifled my pack, and his stuff was in his pack, including a watch which was being given to me by my father. And this had finished up, and I got my own stuff back out of my pack, and I got his pack as well. And that was that. But I'm a little bit vague as to what stage it was in. It was, I think it was in those 2 days.
What was your reaction to actually shooting another human being?
Nothing whatsoever. No feeling whatsoever. Not the slightest. Remorse or anything else. No. It just, even at this stage, it was just he shot me or I shot him, one or the other. But no compassion whatsoever.
So you then were lined up, walking wounded.
That's right.
What happened then?
Well, we walked down this, or crawled and marched and walked, whichever, well, not marched, we just walked best as we could, some stumbling. We kept pausing to let the laggers catch up a little bit, and a little breaks, and eventually it took us all of, I would think, 3 or 4 hours to get down this track, for it was all downhill. We managed a bit near, and we were right down near the road again. And even at this stage, that road was still getting shelled and bombed by the Japanese with the mortar bombs. But there was fleets of ambulances coming up. And I remember at this stage, the ambulances were actually carrying ammunition. And I think later on somewhere or other, before I got back to Dimapur, I helped to load ammunition into these ambulances. And it was purely, they thought the Japanese would let the ambulances go through along the road, where, and they would stop a truck carrying ammunition. But be that as it may, I never know. But however, this particular ambulance unloaded ammunition, and I was surprised, say it was a British ambulance, British military ambulance, but it had a marking on the side, and the words American Volunteer Ambulance Group. And of course, you took your turns.
So this was getting ammunition through from the back area.
That's right,
to the
exactly,
hill.
Back to the base of the hill. You see.
Do you understand, or do you know, had the Japanese spotted that this was going on?
Well, I don't know, because the Japanese were funny people. Now, I never saw an ambulance hit. Oh, that's all I can say on that episode. I never saw one actually hit. You saw the mortar bombs exploding here and there along this road where they were coming. But I never saw an ambulance hit, so whether we were aiming at the ambulances and missing, or they were aiming to miss the ambulance, I never know.
Well, they probably didn't know they were there, that the bomb would be going over the top
that's
and landing
right,
on the road.
Exactly, that's right, aye. However, this, there was, I would think, in this group, this particular group, what I'm involved with, there must have been about 40, 50 men, wounded in various different ways. But none of them, they were all capable of walking, so as the ambulances drew up, we were grouped into groups and put into the ambulance. And I was driven, I remember going back along this road with, I was talking to the American driver, and I said, what the HEU doing out here? Oh, if we just come up to give a hand, he said, or something like that, his broad American accent. And he says, it's rough where your lads have been, though. He says, nothing what we don't compared with up there. And I said, no, you're probably right there, like. However, the ambulance took us all the way back, I think roughly 30 miles, to the base hospital, which was back at Dimapur. And that was where I was put into this, it was a tented hospital, and I was in there for this wound to heal, which took about a fortnight or so before it was practically closed up.
What treatment did they give you?
Yes, basically it was... if I remember the name, it was there was no penicillin in those. It was a powder on a dressing called sulfolamide powder.
Presumably, change of clothing?
Oh, yes, yeah, that was then. And you had, of course, the Red Cross were at that stage. There was people like that, volunteers, and that was pushing about you and all sorts of things. I remember a chap coming up to me, he was a reporter, an Englishman. The reporter must have been the army branch of the press. They had their own people, you know, what do you call them, you know. However, he was going from bed to bed, and he came to me. And in his haughty accent, he wanted to know, well, tell him all about what was happening on top of the hill. I refused point blank. I remember the words coming back to even as now, and I just said, if you want to find out, you go up there and see. And so he went away with his tail between his legs.
Were there nurses?
Yes, there was nurses, British nurses actually at Dimmapur, British Red Cross, you know, the nurses, they were the ones, but all they were, as far as we were concerned, they were nurses like.
How did they treat you in the camp?
Very well, aloof to us, but the duties were first class, I mean, obviously there were nurses, but one of them did say to me, she says, for the past few days, she says, it's been terrible, she never wanted to see anything like it ever again. It's what she'd say coming into the hospital, it's like, not my ours class was relative to be mine alone, mine a lot more were, but there was a lot of serious causes. I mean, the next bed to me, a man was very ill, he'd been shot in his stomach, and everybody, including the doctor, on there, I asked the nurse, I said, how will he do? He says, he's got a 50-50 chance. Now, that same night, there was all this bustle up next bed to me and those to me, and that chap died in the middle of the night. He hemorrhaged and just bled to death in the bed next door, and nothing could do about it.
Was it strictly controlled in a kind of regimental way, the hospital?
Yes, I would say there was... there was no misconduct or anything of any kind. You were threatened, you were given a number and all that, and you were threatened, you weren't addressed and things like that. And I was threatened there, though. You've got to imagine this hospital was a base hospital, so it was, you know, right next to the front line, and it was, you were just like a transit camp, so to get some initial treatment for your wounds. We were moved after that, I think after about 3 or 4 days, when you got over the worst, and were put on a train and sent back to Guwahati, a place called Guwahati, which was a second stage hospital where they carried on your treatment, but you were further away from the fighting at that stage. I suppose it was to give you a chance to recruit mentally from the thing more than anything else, get you away a bit further away from it. However, that was there then after another 3 days.
Was that buildings or tents or what?
They were huts rather than buildings. There were no brick buildings, nothing like that. But I remember from there, this must have been about 10 days after it actually happened, a nurse came and said to me, she said, you're replacing, you're going on a little holiday. I said, well, that's what's about. And I said, where's this? Oh, she said, you go up with a group convalescent to the hill station. Now, a hill station, I'd heard about them, but I'd never seen one, never been in a one. And I said, where's this? She said, that's a place called Shillong. And she said, it's a nice, interesting journey, she said, you'll enjoy it. And however, sure enough it was, we went travelling by train, and we put in this Narragate railway. And we travelled up this hills all the way. Of course, this was back in India now, not Burma. And we got to the hill station, which is in Assam. It was a tea planter's place, because all the tea plantations are surrounded by them. And it was a convalescent place for the wounded troops. And it was a marvellous place because the air was grand, it was much cooler than being up in the hill. Our food was absolutely marvellous, fantastic stuff, more like our British food. And everybody was kind, everything was good. So it was a nice place at that time.
And this was a buildings?
No, it was tents again. There were buildings there, permanent brick buildings. But of course, with the numbers of troops involved, the hospital had mushroomed into a bulk of tents.
Did they leave you to your own devices to relax and rest?
Yes, we had libraries. They brought your libraries round. You could read. You could write letters. They even, believe it or not, I taught one little thing which I've never forgotten ever since. It was to do leather work, of all things. Called occupational therapy, I think they called it. But it all helped. And I remember making a sort of letter holder out of this leather, and they even acquired me a little bit of snakeskin, to put a little bit of embroidery with a snake on it. I give that to my brother when I got home.
Going back to the 2 or 3 days you were on the hill, did you get adequate sleep or little sleep?
Little sleep, really.
Does that affect you in any way?
I slept the first night because I was that worn out and tired. I'd have slept, as I said before, the first night on the hill. But after that, I can't remember any sleep at all till I got back to Dimmapur. And even then, them first days, in the first hospital, we got back to, I suppose mentally, you were just about insane, really, because your thoughts were behind it all was this tremendous feeling of relief. It survived. You're alive. And that's all that mattered. But again, even at that stage, your thoughts kept returning. But what's happened to the mates? What's happened to so-and-so? Tommy Pennick, what's he doing? Is he alive? Is he dead? What's happened to Connery, the officer? Is he alive or dead? But you had no way of knowing, of course.
Lack of sleep, did it affect you in any way?
Yes, there was this feeling of complete weariness over you. It made your movements very slow and sluggish. It was just a weary sort of feeling, a fed-up, weary sort of feeling. But as I said before, behind it all was this relief. You kept saying to yourself, forget it, you're over it, you're out of it, you're safe. And that was underlying, that overcome everything else.